Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar on recent Supreme Court decisions, implications for the business world. Our panelists today are Richard Faulkner, Charles Bennett, and Philip J. Laurie Jr. Richard Faulkner is the principal attorney for Faulkner ADR Law and of counsel for Bennett Injury Law in Dallas, Texas. As a fellow of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators and holder of a diploma in international commercial arbitration, Richard is one of the foremost arbitration experts in the country. Mr. Faulkner has arbitrated over 300 cases and has also been counsel in multiple class action arbitrations, dealing with contract, statutory, and injunction issues in international arbitrations. Charles Bennett is a trial lawyer at Bennett Legal, where he specializes in winning personal injury cases. Charles has secured record-breaking results in a variety of categories, including commercial 18-wheeler crashes, wrongful deaths, specialty in negligent landlord cases, traumatic brain damage cases, motor vehicle crashes, and workplace injuries. Charles is also the captain of the Justice College, an institution whose mission is to empower lawyers to face billion-dollar insurance companies without feeling overwhelmed. Before Bennett Legal, Mr. Bennett was principal of Trial Structure LLC, an educational corporation that catered specifically to trial lawyers. Mr. Philip J. Laurie Jr. is the principal of the Laurie Law Firm. He has 30 years of experience representing clients in complex disputes before federal and state trial and appellate courts and arbitration panels, particularly in domestic and international arbitration law, reinsurance, insurance, and other business and commercial disputes. Before forming Laurie & Laurie in 2008, he practiced for nearly 17 years, one of the leading reinsurance practice groups in the United States, and was a litigation partner at two prominent New York City law firms. When Philip J. Laurie Sr. retired from the practice of law in 2020, Philip J. Laurie Jr. continued the practice of Laurie & Laurie as the Laurie Law Firm. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Richard, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
All right. Thank you, Caroline. This is a topic that is, of course, has great interest for all of us who are or represent companies. And I've been doing that for well over 40 years now. Arbitration is a hot topic. It is the one area outside of criminal law where the United States Supreme Court consistently takes multiple cases every term. This term was unique and very unusual because all three of the cases the U.S. Supreme Court decided were decided by unanimous opinions. And the cases were quite a hot topic at our recent Federalist Society Corporate Council meeting here in Dallas a few months ago. The issue of arbitration is a hot one in many law firms and in corporate counsel circles because we're all encountering it routinely. It is somewhat of a specialist field, and it's a field where particularly in some aspects of arbitration, such as insurance, you can quickly get into trouble if you don't know and understand the really finer points. And there are some tricks and traps that I know Charles and Phil and I have been dealing with for many years. Those are the types of things that we're hoping to make sure that in this and in other Federalist Society arbitration programs, we help those of you who are viewing this to avoid so that you don't get burned and can better represent your clients. So let's begin by talking about the three U.S. Supreme Court cases. And I'm going to ask Phil to begin with Bissonnet versus Lepage Bakeries, Park Street. And Phil, why don't you give us a summary of the case and tell us what the court did?
Okay, Rick. Well, thank you very much. Section 1 of the Federal Arbitration Act, as most of you know, exempts from FAA coverage contracts of employment of seamen, railroad employees, or any other class of workers engaged in foreign or interstate commerce. In a case involving franchisee distributors of a well-known baked goods conglomerate, and this one happens to the flower, it was named Flowers, and it markets Wonder Bread, among other things. The court addressed the question whether the exemption to the FAA was limited to transportation workers who worked in the transportation industry, and or whether you can invoke the exception if as long as what you do involves transportation work and the shipment of the interstate and the like. And what we had in Bissonnette was a case involving franchisee distributors of bakery goods, including their shipment and delivery. And that was the factual predicate that the case arose under. On April 24th, 2024, in a 9-0 opinion, Chief Justice John G. Roberts vacated and remanded a decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, holding that a transportation worker need not work in the transportation industry to fall within the exemption from the FAA provided by Section 1 of the Act. It was a unanimous decision, as Rick had pointed out, and it's important because it provides an FAA exemption to a significantly larger class of workers who can show that they are transportation workers, even though they work for companies that are not engaged in the transportation industry. That's particularly pertinent these days, where you have many companies, particularly larger conglomerates, who are not involved in the transportation industries, but only in the manufacture and distribution of goods, involved with the shipment of those goods, including the shipment and distribution of goods sold by third parties. And examples of that are, of course, Walmart and Amazon. And
Phil, didn't Amazon file an amicus before the court in which it argued it was not a transportation company and its workers should not fall within the exemption because they were an internet company? I guess all those big tractor trailers we see on the roadways were an optical illusion. And so Amazon had a very interesting view in its amicus brief.
Yes, they did. But I think the point, though, is that the court didn't narrow the exemption. As long as you can work for an airline or you can work for in the bakery industry, but if you're involved in shipping goods in interstate commerce, then you can qualify for the exemption.
And doesn't that build on the Supreme Court's earlier decisions in Circuit City versus Adams and Southwest Airlines versus Saxon, which involved the baggage supervisor, ramp supervisor, who ordinarily did not move any form of luggage or cargo, but just happened to occasionally pitch in. And the Supreme Court found that, I believe, that lady was exempt. And Charles, haven't you had some cases where there were helpers or loaders or unloaders on motor vehicles, particularly transport trucks, that were within the exemption?
Yeah, so we've had some cases against Amazon where the workers were in the warehouse, and there was we were certainly looking at the issue of whether if they're handling boxes and moving them from one location to another within the warehouse, is that a direct and necessary role in the movements of goods across borders? And I think this Bissonnette case kind of opens that up even further. I mean, you mentioned Circuit City Stores versus Adams and New Prime and Southwest Airlines versus Saxon have all kind of continued to open this area up to more litigation. And I think it's interesting how the court in Bissonnette talks about wanting to avoid litigation over the transportation industry requirement, because the FAA, they say, is intended to limit the amount of litigation. I think we'll get to some of that later in the Coinbase case when we talk about that, about how much litigation these opinions really open this up to for somebody like me who's normally on the plaintiff side.
Yeah, that's okay. Rick, Bill? Add to what you were just saying, but the case in Bissonnette, the court relied not only on the language of Section 1, but also on all, on those three cases that you mentioned. And I think in particular, at one point, I think it was in another webinar that you and I participated in, the prediction that we made prior to the Bissonnette case being decided is that it would be decided in this way. And it followed quite naturally, I thought, from the Southwest Airlines case, where you had a ramp supervisor, as you mentioned, who mm-hmm. was, you know, from time to time involved in unloading and offloading goods onto or luggage onto airplanes. So, you know, and then they made it, an argument was made in that case that since Southwest Airlines was in the transportation industry, that should be enough. And the court said, well, no, that's not enough. What really counts is what the workers do. And so at least, you know, from my perspective, I've always kind of seen this and that as kind of an unsurprising offshoot of Southwest Airlines.
I agree with you on that. I mean, it was not a surprise whatsoever. The unanimity was a surprise, but I think the court felt that it had appropriately limited the exemption by requiring that the exempt workers have a direct and necessary role in the movement of goods across interstate or international borders, and that appropriately narrows down Section 1's exemption so that it still preserves the idea behind the efficiency of the FAA. The court still believes arbitration is faster, cheaper, more efficient, et cetera. They're about 30 years behind the times on that because arbitration is no longer any of those things. Just ask anyone who gets a bill for a AAA arbitration. And, you know, so the court is trying to preserve it, but also follow the text of the Arbitration Act. So let's switch, guys, to the next case, which is Smith versus Sparese. And Phil, why don't you outline that one for us?
All righty. Let's see. On May 16th, 2024, the U.S. Supreme Court in Smith versus Sparese decided 9-0. Again, we have a unanimous decision that Section 3 of the Federal Arbitration Act does not, quote, permit a court to dismiss the case instead of issuing a stay when a dispute is subject to arbitration and a party requests a stay pending arbitration. And now, in an opinion written by Associate Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the court concluded that the text, structure, and purpose of Section 3 and the FAA all point to the same conclusion. When a federal court finds that a dispute is subject to arbitration and a party has requested a stay, that's important to keep that in mind, of the court proceedings pending arbitration, the court does not have the discretion to dismiss the suit on the basis that all the claims are subject to arbitration. And the court therefore held that if a lawsuit involves an arbitrable dispute and a party requests a Section 3 stay, the court must stay the litigation. And this was there was quite a split in the circuits on this issue.
Yes, there was.
Going back, I mean, the Supreme Court, I think on two different occasions, didn't take it up. It's a very important. It's a simple case, you know, as I've just described. I mean, you could, the case could have been decided just on the language of Section 3, because that's essentially what Section 3 says. If you have an arbitrable dispute and somebody requests a stay of arbitration, then the court has to, and the court shall grant the stay. And you know, so it was pretty straightforward.
I think the court actually put in the opinion that the use of shall, quote, establishes an obligation impervious to judicial discretion.
Yes.
So it
yes.
Besides, shall mean shall.
Shall means shall. And the court said stay means stay. Was the yes. And yet Justice Sotomayor, you know, also got into the you know, the you know, the purpose and context of Section 1. It's a straightforward opinion on a fairly narrow procedural issue, but it has some significant consequences. And I think I'd say it's the most decision that's most favorable to arbitration proponents of all the three that were decided in this term.
Well, let me ask about that, Phil, because one of the things I think the business audience is going to be concerned about is, okay, so stay means stay, and that should suggest that the federal court will then supervise the appointment of arbitrators if necessary, or even appoint arbitrators and enforce subpoenas. But there's a problem because of a prior U.S. Supreme Court case called Bajereau.
Yes.
And it raises huge jurisdictional issues. And let me throw something out for you, because, of course, dealing in the insurance, reinsurance world and in the maritime world over the years, we would sometimes have partial final awards.
Yes.
Now, where do we confirm those? Because if under Bajereau, unless we have complete diversity, if we try to go to the federal courts, we now have a Fifth Circuit and I believe a Second Circuit opinion saying there's no jurisdiction. At what point does federal jurisdiction, absent complete diversity, disappear, where we have to then go back to state courts? Because this opens the door to tremendous amounts of mischief. And I can see Charles smiling because he knows exactly the kinds of issues that can come up with this. So either of y'all, any thoughts on if there's a partial final award, does that then terminate the federal court's jurisdiction?
Well, let me address that. In terms of partial final awards and interim awards and the like, I mean, I think the first issue that you consider is whether or not, you know, the award is sufficiently final so that you can support confirmation. Now, right. I think what you're referring to here is mostly in a federal jurisdiction, in a federal question, a jurisdiction case, you know,
correct,
under a federal statute or something, somebody brings a lawsuit and then somebody compels arbitration and then asks for a stay, and then you have a stay. Well, under Bajereau, that raises an important question as to whether or not the court in which the action was brought has that kind of continuing jurisdiction. Spezieri alluded to the court under the FAA having supervisory power, but it cautioned that by saying in a case where the court has jurisdiction. So it has kind of equivocal language, I think, in terms of whether or not the mere existence or necessity for a stay creates federal jurisdiction, in the sense of like anchor jurisdiction or continuing jurisdiction. Guess what? There's a big split in the circuits right now on mm-hmm. this very issue. And if you look at there's a First Circuit case called Smart Sky Networks LLC versus DAG Wireless LTD. And that's 93F4th 175 for anybody who's interested. Now, what it said was where the suit is based on federal question jurisdiction, you need something other than federal question jurisdiction to support a motion to compel, even if there's been a stay. And, you know, the court doesn't automatically have that jurisdiction. The court in the Seventh Circuit, also post Badgero, ruled that to the contrary, it says a split in the circuits, that the court has a continuing jurisdiction to hear applications for other FAA relief. And there are a number of cases that were decided before Badgero, which would support, for example, in the Second Circuit and other places where the court has said there's jurisdiction, continuing jurisdiction or anchor jurisdiction. So I don't, you know, I think the key issue is probably is more, where are we on anchor jurisdiction? You said you're in the Second Circuit. I said you're pretty darn good chance of getting the court to assert continuing jurisdiction. I would look carefully at Spezieri. There, I would quote the language there, but mm-hmm. with the caveat that it's not conclusive. I wrote an article earlier this year. It was really a three-part article. in part because Spezieri was decided when two parts of the article had gone out. But in the article, I talk about all these issues and what Section 3 has to do with it in terms of jurisdiction and whether there should be continuing or not, and critique Smart Sky. So if anybody's interested in reading that, you can email me at pjl1@larelawfirm.com. And I can get permission, I hope, from CPR to send you a copy. Otherwise, it's one that you have to be a member of CPR to get it. But yes, that's a very important issue, Rick. And another key issue about this case is the whole appeal issue, and that is if you're Let's go back to Bissonnette. In Bissonnette, the arbitration proponent did not request a stay of arbitration. Now, granted, it was before Spezieri, and the Second Circuit law is, in effect, at the time, was basically the same as Spezieri. But they didn't request that. So what happened in Bissonnette is that the case ended up getting dismissed. And guess what? We had something like, two or three appellate decisions that came up on the Second Circuit before we got to the Supreme Court in Bissonnette. None of that had to happen. If the arbitration proponent had just moved for a stay, then they would have gotten it under Second Circuit law. And this could have been avoided. And Chuck, I'm sure you could appreciate that, in particular, that would put the plaintiffs to have to go through the whole arbitration before there's any, you know, without any litigation. That doesn't put the plaintiffs in a very good, strong position.
It's a very difficult spot. And so it's kind of, over the years, I've run into several lawyers on the defense side who think the case has to be non-suited and terminated. And I'm fine with that because I can appeal it if the motion to compel is granted. So this Spezieri, I think, helps to clarify what a lot of practitioners on both sides of the V misunderstand, which is how to use the courts in conjunction with the arbitration. I'm kind of loosely involved in an arbitration right now in Arizona where the company defendant has obtained a subpoena to get a deposition of a woman that lives out of state, and there's no lawsuit pending. And so there's no way for them to move to confirm that subpoena. And so I'm getting questions about, well, what does the witness do? I'm like, just ignore it for now. There's no way that they can enforce that subpoena without court action in both states. And so the practitioners need to understand how to use the court system along with the arbitration so that in Texas, the Texas Arbitration Act has the in aid of arbitration or in support of arbitration. The court systems are supposed to be there to help make sure the arbitration is run in a smooth and orderly process. So I think this is helpful for both sides of the V to keep that case pending. But it's also interesting that there are still cases going on without that support from the court system.
and always having the fun of being a devil's advocate to promote discussion on this. You know, as our audience probably knows, the three of us could sit here and discuss the fine points of arbitration for the next millennium. But to follow up on some of the cases that folks should look at post Sparese, the Ascension Data and Analytics versus Rocktop Partners out of the Fifth Circuit, which was handed down at the end of June of this year in the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal. It's on it's a case that was appealed out of the Northern District, addresses the lack of jurisdiction issue. And then there's another case out of, I believe, let me flip to the other circuit, United Mine Workers, which is the D.C. Circuit, International United Mine Workers of America International versus Consolidated Energy. It is worth everyone reading these cases because there are going to be some fine points here that are both problems and opportunities for those of us who are involved in these issues. So, you know, we're going to get to learn a whole lot more about federal jurisdiction and where it actually extends and where it ends. So we still have another case, guys, and I'm trying to keep us on track for the time frame that the Federalist Society gave us. So sometimes I forget and have more fun being a devil's advocate than anything else. So let's turn to Coinbase versus Suskie. And Phil, can you outline that one for us?
Absolutely. And just as an aside, I was about, and I will not get into how Sparese interacts with the Coinbase versus Bielski case of last year. But that would take, I mean, it's very interesting stuff and has to do with the appeal and the capability. But let's
arbitration nerds can talk to Phil and I, and we'll be happy to do that.
Yeah, we're unstoppable.
Charles will join in.
Yes. Okay. Well, we're just getting warmed up here anyway. But let's talk about the third case. That's Coinbase versus Suskie, and it was decided on May 23rd, 2024. It was also a unanimous decision, and it was of the three decisions, it was the only one in which any of the other justices even filed another opinion. In it, Justice Gorsuch filed a very short concurring opinion, which, as you'll see, raises a very interesting issue about infinite arbitration clauses and ties in very nicely to some, you know, the Disney case that you've probably been following over the last month or so. But let's, Suskie concerned the allocation of power between courts and arbitrators in a situation in which agreements with conflicting dispute resolution provisions cover or appear to cover some or all of the same disputed subject matter. What you had specifically was Coinbase had a user agreement, and that user agreement had a very broad arbitration clause and had a delegation clause under which the arbitrators clearly unmistakably had the power to decide arbitrability questions. So if that's all we had going on with the case, there wouldn't be a case, and that's exactly what Coinbase said. But there was more. Coinbase had a sweepstakes, and it sponsored to win Dogecoin.
Something like that.
Something like that. But anyway, that was governed by so-called general rules and sweepstake rules or something like that, that were contractually binding on the people who participated in the sweepstakes, all of whom, of course, had Coinbase user agreements. These general rules provided a California forum selection clause
that said that
all disputes had to be decided by a court in California, state or federal. So that was the background on the general, at least from the court's perspective, the general principles and rules of arbitrability as applied to those facts didn't clearly answer the question of who gets to decide whether the party's merits dispute, i.e. the dispute about the sweepstakes, was arbitrable. But the court in a 9-0 opinion, and it was authored by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, created a new rule of arbitrability, something we haven't really seen since First Options versus Chicago, the First Options of Chicago versus Kaplan. And under that rule, where parties have agreed to two contracts, one sending arbitrability disputes to arbitration and the other either explicitly or implicitly sending arbitrability disputes to the courts, a court must decide which contract governs. And applying the new rule to the facts, the court concluded that the court, not an arbitrator, must decide whether the Coinbase two parties' first agreement was superseded by their second. Identifying what outcome made the most sense in Coinbase 2 was not particularly difficult. This is the outcome that we all expected, that a court would have to make this decision. But charting to that outcome an analytical path, most in line with the FAA and these cases decided under it, was really the challenge. The court's approach, I think, by establishing this rule, and you can get into the reasoning and whatnot at your leisure, but you know, it provides, you know, some real guidance in this kind of a situation where you have conflicting clauses. Now, that's all well and good, but Justice Gorsuch authored a very short concurring opinion, and what he said. He wrote to emphasize that the court's opinion recognizes and stresses that arbitration is a matter of contract and parties can agree by contract that an arbitrator rather than a court will resolve threshold arbitrability questions as well as underlying merits disputes. The court's opinion, Justice Gorsuch said, merely, quote, reaffirms well-established principles about the primacy of the parties' agreements when it comes to arbitration, and the Ninth Circuit's, that was the court below, bottom line conclusion that a court had to decide whether and to what extent the parties agreed to arbitrate arbitrability. So to illustrate his understanding of the limited scope of the opinion, he posited a hypothetical delegation provision, yes, that he said would likely require a court to conclude that the delegation agreement, not the forum selection clause, governed in a case like this. And this is what he posited, quoting from his opinion. Just imagine a master contract providing that, quote, all disputes arising out of or related to this or future agreements, he focused on that, between the parties, including questions concerning whether a dispute should be routed to arbitration, shall be decided by an arbitrator. And what he said was, absent some later amendment, a provision like that would seem to require a court to step aside. Now, the question that Rick and I and I think and Chuck have had about that this concurrence is that, it was Justice Gorsuch impliedly endorsing what has been referred to as a, quote, infinite arbitration clause. Professor David Horton has referred to clauses like the one Gorsuch proposed to be infinite arbitration clauses. That is, an agreement to mandate arbitration for all disputes between any related party in perpetuity. So it certainly had the perpetuity aspect here. Professor Horton wrote a very interesting article on the subject of infinite arbitration clauses. It's David Horton, Infinite Arbitration Clauses, 168 U. PA Law Review 633-2019-2020.
Well, Phil, the practical aspect of this is something that I think you and I have seen before, which is that I know you're familiar with a case in which I also looked at it, and a $3 billion company was destroyed because 10 years before, their opponent in an arbitration was even created, they had agreed to a settlement agreement with an arbitration provision and an assignment provision, garden variety, boilerplate assignment. typical midnight clause of AAA arbitration, where everybody's about to pop the champagne and somebody says, oh, let's throw an arbitration provision in there. So they threw in the standard one of those days. And Monster Energy came in it was involved in numerous disputes with its opponent, Bang, and they bought the right to arbitrate with their lawyers and basically ambushed the their competitor and ended up with a $220 million arbitration award that destroyed the company that, you know, found out that they had agreed to arbitrate based on a contract 10 years in existence before Monster Energy even existed. And I mean, it was insidiously brilliant on Monster's part.
Oh, absolutely.
Lawfare at its finest. Sun Tzu would admire this.
To a team.
But it destroyed a multi-billion dollar company because of the coordination of an old arbitration and a boilerplate ancient assignment provision that then led to arbitration that no one expected. Walgreens has certainly experienced two huge awards that together total almost $2 billion, AAA arbitrations that went horribly sideways. And so this is beginning to be a major problem for corporate America. Charles, you had something you wanted to add, because I know where you're going to go, and please do. Yes.
Well, I wanted to make clear, in the case that you're talking about with Bang Energy, Monster bought a competitor, the company, and would by buying
They didn't buy the whole company. They just bought the right use the arbitration provision.
That's right. It was they bought the right.
That's amazing. They just buy the right contract. And then go ahead, Phil. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, no, I agree with you 100%. I mean, it was incredible. And really the argument, we never got a chance to appeal that case for reasons that have, nothing to do with its merits, but the the issue there was really, is this something the parties under California law could reasonably expect? And there were cases, at least in California law, that suggested that we may have been able to one on that.
Yes. Charles, I think you had another angle that you wanted to address with regard to this. And then we're going to probably have to start looking at taking questions. But there's a huge issue with regards to the making of agreements to arbitrate and the rights to jury trials on that issue. And right. Why don't you address that?
So that leads us to Section 4 of the FAA, which multiple times mentions jury trials. And the question would be when especially Gorsuch's concurrence, but the whole opinion from the court is saying that the court has to decide this issue under Section 4, the issue of what contract prevails in these multiple conflicting contracts. The question then becomes, does Section 4 of the FAA allow for a jury trial on that issue, on the specific issue of which contract prevails? What was the agreement between the parties? And so by just reading the plain language of Section 4, it appears to say that if one party asks for it in this hypothetical that Gorsuch is talking about, or the case with Coinbase, is do the parties have to go to a jury trial to decide which contract prevails and whether they have to go to arbitration or not?
Or go to a jury trial on did anyone make a viable agreement to arbitrate. And that gets into what has now been charmingly described by the Federal Trade Commission as dark patterns and some of the other shenanigans that are used through browser wrap contracts, click wrap contracts, if you go back and look at Doe versus Airbnb, where the couple were surreptitiously videoed in intimate moments in the Airbnb while they were on vacation, they were sent into arbitration based on a provision that they then had to go and read the terms and conditions of the Airbnb contract to find out there was an arbitration provision that then referred them to another through a hyperlink to the AAA arbitration rules. And then they had to go and click on yet another link, which may or may not have been active, to find out that there was a delegation of arbitrability. So my brilliant drafting that resulted in Rent-A-Center versus Jackson, continues to cause headaches for people from one end of this country to another. But we now have this infinite arbitration problem. And, Charles, I think jury trials are something you really enjoy. I haven't done them in a while.
I love them. And that's what I'm trying to do on the plaintiff side is get cases back to the Seventh Amendment of the civil right to a jury trial and how arbitration is affecting that. And especially these browser wrap and clip wrap agreements and the infinite arbitration. It was interesting a few weeks ago that the Disney case kind of blew up. Yes. At Disney base in Florida, where a couple goes to eat at a Disney resort. Yes. Or a Disney owned resort. And the woman who was a doctor, the wife, warns the restaurant multiple times that she has an allergy. The restaurant serves her food and she ends up dying from the allergy from the food. And then Disney Plus, after the lawsuit is filed against Disney, comes forth with an arbitration agreement from a Disney Plus subscription that the husband had signed 4 years before that had nothing to do with the restaurant and nothing to do with that trip. And so those kinds of issues, I think, are coming up more and more. And companies especially need to understand that just because you have an arbitration agreement in the contract does not protect you 100%. And that leads us to our first question that I'll read out and then let you guys talk about. It says, given the expense of arbitration and the potential for abuse of arbitration, would you recommend arbitration to a corporate client?
I'll jump in first. Generally, no. And despite my background in arbitration for way over 40 years, the simple fact is it is not more efficient. It is not cost effective. And unless you have specific needs such as international arbitration or highly dedicated subject matter expertise, the cost of arbitrations now has frequently made it effectively unaffordable. I've had small business clients driven into bankruptcy by the cost of a AAA arbitration, and that has been a huge problem. More and more frequently, we are seeing that the cost of arbitration, the case Phil and I alluded to involving well-known companies, the arbitrator personally, I believe, charged $1.1 million. It is very common to see the cost of a single AAA arbitration be more than the annual profits of a small company, including small auto dealerships. And that's just not sustainable. It's bad enough they've got to pay, lawyers like us. But when you get into all of the other expenses of arbitration, particularly if it's not a large, very well-funded company, it just doesn't make economic sense anymore. Phil, do you want to chime in on?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to ask the question of what industry is the company involved in? What kinds of disputes are you likely to be involved in? Are you talking about intra-industry type disputes? And having a long background in reinsurance and insurance disputes, I would say assuming the arbitration system that you're using is sufficiently fair and is then you may well be better off in a lot of cases anyway with arbitration. You got to even in the industry sense, like if you're on one reinsurer versus another, you have to realize that you're going to find that there are some classes of cases where you're going to be better off in arbitration, and some classes of cases where you'll be worse off in arbitration. So you have to.
I represented Wyndham Hotels and all their Hurricane Katrina claims, and we had four recalcitrant insurers in the insurance tower that would not pay. Everyone else did. And while Wyndham was trying to rebuild its hotel and still sweeping water out, they had to come up with $250,000 in deposits lawsuits for each of the four international arbitrations. We did settle them eventually. It took like a year and a half. And I can't discuss what the settlements were, but the cost of those arbitrations was very high. And, you know, my clients are sitting there, their structure has been horribly damaged by Hurricane Katrina, and they're stuck in an arbitration with insurance carriers that refuse to pay. And now they have to come up with $1 million. I mean, that's pretty tough.
Yeah, and I'm talking about intra-industry cases, one insurance company right. versus another. If you're talking about a coverage case, I mean, I'm representing.
Yes, and we have a number of those.
Insurance and say, no, I don't want you to arbitrate. Definitely not. Don't want you to arbitrate.
I think I'm more on the Phil side here is that I think it depends on whether an arbitration agreement is good for a business or not. And I think some businesses need to through the consequences of not having insurance to cover the claims that an arbitration agreement arguably covers, because that's when I think small and medium-sized businesses get into trouble, is if they have a breach of contract claim that insurance is not going to cover. And now the company is on the hook for half or even all sometimes of the arbitration costs, the arbitrator's costs, their own lawyer's costs, sometimes the other side's costs. And the cost can very quickly get out of control. And it's not as well known, I think, by lawyers what those costs can be, whereas in litigation, yes, they are. Absolutely. So I think gone are the days where, like you were talking about earlier, Rick, where a lawyer writing a contract just throws an arbitration provision in because he's heard it's a better, cheaper, faster.
They aren't gone yet, but I will tell you at the recent Federalist Society GC meeting, there was a general counsel of a well-known national U.S. company who said he no longer allows anyone in the legal department to agree arbitration without his personal vetting and an explanation to him of exactly why they would be agreeing arbitration, because it has become so cost ineffective. And that leads to a great question that just came up a couple of minutes ago. Charles, if you'd read that.
I was looking at that. I knew you were going to be excited about it. It says, is it possible to draft a clause that avoids AAA fees, like a clause that says we'll follow the AAA rules but administer our own arbitration? Go, Rick.
Yes. And in fact, that was something that we've done for many years by specifying the qualifications of the arbitrators. And the AAA became sufficiently concerned about that they changed their rules a few years ago to say that if you mention the AAA rules, you have ostensibly agreed to AAA administration, which is precisely what many of us avoid like plague. So what generally is done is specify the qualifications of the arbitrator, specify the number, specify the educational background, et cetera. And then you can find arbitrators. The AAA is not the only source. You've got people with JAMS. Now, JAMS arbitrators are exclusive to JAMS, but they also sometimes sit on other arbitration panels. They're allowed to do that. You've got new entities like New Era that is highly technological. I think it was formed by some former GCs of tech companies. IICPR will provide you lists of arbitrators on a independent basis. The London Court of International Arbitration will assist with lists of arbitrators, or actually administer on an hourly basis to the extent you require any administration. Center for Public Resources has a phenomenal set of non-administered arbitration rules, drafted, very well conceived. Disclosure, I had a hand in having to and creating some of those and creating the rules on summary disposition, but it's extremely well done. It doesn't cost businesses anything to use those CPR non-administered rules. And, you know, if you want to have administration, great. It occasionally has benefits. But frankly, I think the benefits of administration are oversold. I've chaired many an arbitration tribunal where the tribunal chair just did the administration. We charge maybe $25 or $50 an hour more. And frankly, our paralegals and our law clerks did the administration. Charles was the tribunal secretary in the Lance Armstrong cases I chaired. And he did all of the administrative work. And, you know, the parties avoided tens of thousands of dollars in unnecessary administration fees.
Yeah,
Bill, did you have something?
Yeah, you have that in a lot of industry arbitration too, where it's all ad hoc arbitration. Most of the reinsurance cases I was involved in several years ago were, I mean, we didn't have administrators. We didn't even have rules in most cases, and you know, there were kind of traditional norms and rules that you would follow. But a lot of, you know, but if you got into a dispute, the umpire would resolve it. So and certainly you can save a lot of money if you get into that situation. The problem is like most things, something that works in the intra-industry context isn't necessarily and probably isn't going to work in all other contexts in straight commercial cases.
It's interesting. Both CPR and now IICPR will go in, and if you have an impasse over the appointment of the umpire, the proper technical term for the chairman of a tribunal, they'll appoint one. And then they step back off stage. And so that's another way that companies can save significant amounts of money. I've been the umpire slash chairman numerous times, including on insurance coverage cases. And, you know, we were perfectly capable of administering all of that ourselves. We did not need administrators. And, you know, that allowed companies to actually have arbitration be cost efficient. It is something that, frankly, a lot of companies should be looking at. Go back to non-administered arbitration. Look seriously at party-appointed arbitrators. That is still the norm in the insurance, reinsurance field and in coverage. I often thought that much of the drive to purely neutral tribunals was a marketing gimmick from certain administering organizations, because if a company wants to ensure that arbitration works and it appoints a party-appointed arbitrator who can be predisposed but not biased, an interesting set of points, then they can pick a chairman. And most of the time we successfully picked chairman when I've been able to be a party appointed arbitrator, and we haven't had any problems. And then the chairman administered the arbitration from there. And these are oftentimes cases with millions or tens of millions of dollars at stake, sometimes even more than that. And we didn't need any administration. But, you know, if somebody really just wants to do the standard and pay the cost, they can go with the administered arbitrations, or they can be creative. Frankly, for small businesses, medium-sized businesses that I tend to represent in the past, we preferred it non-administered because it saved us a small fortune.
Yeah.
So, Charles, you had something you wanted to add?
I do. I want to bring up an issue that I don't know is obvious to everybody on the unadministered arbitration side. And that's what we were talking about earlier with Spazieri. Is it, Phil, if we have an unadministered arbitration clause, mm-hmm. does that still allow for oversight of the courts on that arbitration?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Assuming the jurisdictional requirements are met, and there's kind of an open question about that after Badgero, but the answer is yes.
And so I think it would be a good cautionary tale to say you still have to, even though it's unadministered, is you still need an arbitration agreement that meets standards for example, you can't make a consumer pay for half of the costs. If there's an arbitration appeal within it, the business needs to pay. And all of those things still apply because you're subject to court supervision, even though it is unadministered.
That's true.
Correct. Y'all, it's 11:56. Do we have any other questions from anyone else in the audience? Because we'll try to answer them if we can in the 3 minutes that are left.
I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you guys so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc. Stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.